Listener warning. This episode contains descriptions of rioting-type violence, sex in the street, and Rich uses the term "the man" a few too many times. Listener discretion is advised. This is Ann Arbor Stories. I'm Rich Reddy. Quote, "The sad events of last night were not a police riot. They were not Chicago all over again. On Monday night, a group of young people, almost none of them from the university, attempted to take over a city street. Last night, a group attempted to take over the same street again. The group came armed with bottles, cement bricks, and other weapons, and lay down in the street. When the police ordered them to leave, one youth attacked a police officer with a knife, and others threw rocks at police. We will not allow South University to be taken over by a small group who declare themselves to be the people. I hope there is no further trouble along South University. I ask students, in the event of further trouble, to stay off the streets and not join in." End quote. Ann Arbor Mayor Robert J. Harris, in an open letter to the university student community. Four nights of rioting, dozens of injuries to cops and citizens, and more than 70 arrests. An event the Detroit Free Press dubbed the Battle of Ann Arbor. A fire sparked by something so stupid. Motorcycle wheelies. It was the early summer of 1969, Monday, June 16th, down on South University Avenue. A typical crowd of students staying over summer, mixed with townies and visitors. A sparse Monday night crowd mingling among the bars and restaurants and shops near Central Campus. It was 10 p.m. when an Ann Arbor police officer rolled up on a motorcyclist popping wheelies down the middle of South U and put his flashers on. The scene drew quite a crowd, the red and blue lights of the cruiser bouncing off the buildings in the street. A crowd of 50 onlookers slowly advanced, inserting themselves into the traffic stop. First, shouting obscenities, then edging threateningly closer. Four backup patrol cars arrived, bathing the scene in bouncing lights. But the tiny police presence was no match for the growing number of people and the volume of voices. The crowd eventually swelled to more than 300. The officers retreated without issuing a citation, and the crowd celebrated their victory over the man. Maybe a little too hard. 300 revelers grew to 500, and eventually 1,000. Folks the Ann Arbor News said were mostly students and hippies. They claimed one city block of South U between Forest and Church and had a party. A wine drinking, firecracker throwing, music playing, dope smoking, singing and dancing party. They blocked the street with parked cars, lit fires, shouted at the moon, and in at least one case, had sex in the street. They spray painted love on parking signs and busted a few windows, but for the most part, kept it good, clean fun. A few undercover police officers mingled through the crowd to make sure nothing got too out of hand, while officers from Ann Arbor and the Sheriff's Department massed nearby in case they were needed. They weren't. By 1 a.m., the temperature dropped and the crowd thinned. Eventually, the partygoers moved indoors, and a handful returned with brooms to clean up. Word got out about the giant hippie street party the night before. The White Panther Party saw this as a great opportunity to push for change on South U. They demanded the city close South University for three blocks, from Washtenaw to East University, to create a pedestrian mall for students. Not a terrible idea, but the fact that the White Panther Party was involved didn't sit well with a lot of people in power. A quick footnote on the White Panther Party. They formed in 1968, answering the Black Panthers' question, "What are white people doing to support the Black Panthers?" They were especially active in Detroit and Ann Arbor, operating on the radical left and including in their original manifesto, bullet point, "Total assault on the culture by any means necessary, including sex, drugs, rock and roll, and f***ing in the streets." Bullet point, "Free all prisoners everywhere." Bullet point, "Free all soldiers at once." Bullet point, "Free the people from their leaders." Word got around that the White Panthers were instigating another street takeover for that Tuesday night, bigger and better than the previous evening. Townies heard about it, students heard about it, pretty much anyone who was interested in having a good time or striking a blow against the man or rubbernecking while people partying in the streets, they heard about it. And obviously, the man heard about it. Ann Arbor Police Chief Walter Krasny issued a statement. "We are going to control the streets of Ann Arbor and not give in to a bunch of people who think they own it." Krasny and his lieutenants drew up a plan to own the streets that Tuesday night. The hippies and radicals prepared by stretching and hydrating, no doubt. As the sun set, the sidewalks along South University started to fill up. Then the crowds edged onto the curbs and then into the street until blocks were occupied by somewhere between 1,000 and 2,500 anxious youths and looky-loos. The partygoers barricaded the street once again, and the second night of revelry started. A wine-drinking, firecracker-throwing, music-playing, dope-smoking, singing and dancing party. Though this time, the police weren't massed blocks away waiting for something to go wrong. This time, Krasny's men stood 200 strong at Washtenaw Avenue, riot gear and billy clubs, while 100 reinforcements were inbound on buses, called in from as far away as Oakland County. The police used a bullhorn to get the crowd to disperse, but come on. So they did what Krasny promised they would: control the streets. I can't imagine hitting someone with a club. What it must feel like to grip the handle on that thing, take aim at another human being, and consciously decide to swing. Most of us swung bats and tennis rackets and pool noodles. The muscle memory is there. I've whacked plenty of sporting equipment and a few pinatas. But this is different. These were kids. Maybe annoying kids, maybe high kids, maybe aggressive kids. But the arrest list published in the Ann Arbor News the following day, with names, ages, and occupations, were applicable. It's full of kids. 17, 18, most of them teens. Krasny couldn't lose his streets to these radicals and hippies, so his officers did what it took to get them back. Even if the party would have died down and some of them would have come back later with brooms. The police waded into the crowd, first trying to disperse with fear and some light pushing, then with blows. Many of the tourists fled in the face of the phalanx of cops clad in riot gear, but an element within the crowd fought back, throwing rocks, bricks, and bottles. Washtenaw County Sheriff Doug Harvey ordered tear gas fired into the crowd. It took an hour to clear South University, to disperse the crowd down side streets or onto campus. Police then swept the neighborhoods, using clubs and the butts of their rifles to prevent auxiliary gatherings and get kids out of the area. Some officers found themselves a good distance inside Michigan's campus, breaking up groups of 3, 4, or 5 kids and firing tear gas at least once, even though many of the kids they set upon threw their hands up and screamed that they were just walking home from the library. 2 dozen arrests were made and South U was quiet. They thought the night was over. It wasn't. Stragglers eventually massed in front of the University of Michigan President's House, where President Robin Fleming lived. Police regrouped on South U just east of the crowd and readied in battle formation, while President Fleming begged Sheriff Harvey to show restraint. Fleming stood in front of the UM digs, took the bullhorn and tried to calm the crowd, but someone threw a brick at the cops just yards away. The order was given to clear those kids out. More clubs, more bricks and bottles, more tear gas. Kids fleeing down side streets, chased by cops in riot gear with guns in their holsters, some running with rifles in their hands. 47 arrests in all were made, and 26 of those kids charged with felonies, violating Michigan's new riot statute, created after the infamous Detroit race riots 2 years earlier. This new law made inciting a riot punishable by up to 10 years in prison. President Fleming lightly condemned the police, criticizing the use of tear gas, but ultimately praised their work. Ann Arbor Mayor Robert Harris, who you heard from at the top, was much more supportive. Eyewitness accounts of the evening paint a picture of police exercising extreme power. A Detroit news photographer said he'd spent 80 hours on the streets during the 1967 Detroit riots and never saw police behave the way they did in Ann Arbor. Along with fellow reporters and photographers, he said he was clubbed several times on the legs and back and witnessed 15 to 20 cops chase a single kid down a street, knock him to the ground, surround him, and club and kick him while he writhed on the ground. An Ann Arbor native and Vietnam War vet was sitting with friends on a porch watching the riot in progress. A fleeing teen burst past them and into their apartment, chased by police who bull rushed anyone in the vicinity, assuming they were all rioters. The vet was pushed into a corner where they kicked and beat him with rifle butts before marching the whole lot of them out of the apartment with their hands on top of their heads. Quote, "I could tell you much more," he told the Ann Arbor News, "but my parents and I have to live in this town." It wasn't all one-sided. 15 police officers were treated for injuries, including Deputy Police Chief Harold Olson and Sheriff Harvey. A 17-year-old boy was charged with felonious assault after he allegedly tried to stab Olson early in the riot. On the third day, Wednesday, June 18th, the University and City of Ann Arbor organized a rock concert at the university's administration building to draw people away from South University. The nighttime concert drew more than 2,000 people. Speeches were made by President Fleming and the mayor, and the mood was peaceful and fun. Meanwhile, on South University, 300 police officers from six agencies lined the street, supported by police dogs, an armored car with a machine gun turret, and a helicopter hovering overhead. As the concert ended and thousands walked through campus and down to South U to check things out, everyone remained calm. By 11 o'clock, the crowd had dispersed, the temperature dropped, and it seemed like the night was over. The police relaxed their shoulders, climbed into their buses, and left. And just like in front of the president's house the night before, a small crowd formed on South U. A few dozen, and then 100, they started blocking the street again and claiming South U for the people. The grown-ups on the block tried to reason with them, but it didn't do any good. Radios crackled to life, police dogs smelled the adrenaline, the cops in riot gear returned, this time positioning 100 officers at the east end of University and 100 officers to the west. They fixed bayonets on their rifles, and Deputy Chief Olson ordered these men to clear the street. They leveled their rifles and advanced on hundreds of kids. This was the summer before Kent State, but these kids knew better than to challenge guns with giant knives on the end. Isolated clashes broke out as kids fled down side streets, but only two injuries were reported. No police officers suffered damage. Well, not physical damage. By 2 a.m., the streets were clear, and the third round of the Battle of Ann Arbor was over. The sun rose on the fourth day, and the city and university reevaluated their plan. They'd hold another rock concert by the administration building, but this time there would be no visible police presence on South U. The cops would hold back in reserve, just in case. Thousands showed up again to dance and drink and smoke pot, and when the concert was over, they dispersed throughout the city instead of heading straight for South U, because this time, there wasn't a massive police army and good boy police dogs to ogle. Small groups gathered, but it started raining pretty hard, and everyone opted to stay dry rather than try to claim this stretch of road and fight the police one more time. This is the way the battle ends. This is the way the battle ends. This is the way the Battle of Ann Arbor ends. Not with a bang, but a whimper. Ann Arbor Stories is presented by Rumble Pack Media in partnership with the Ann Arbor District Library. This episode was written and read by me, Rich Reddy, with recording and sound production by Brian Peters. Thanks as always to the Ann Arbor District Library and their archive staff for their research assistant and assistants, we're going to keep that edit in their assistants, and being championship level humans. Please follow us at, I'm going to keep this one too, please follow us on Twitter at Ann Arbor Stories, or drop us a line at AnnArborStories@gmail.com. We want to hear what you thought of this episode or any of the previous stories. We'll try and hit all our deadlines. Thanks again for listening.